Do you want victory? You can have it in Christ Jesus.
Time once again for Abiding in Christ with Jim Wood.
You have to step back, evaluate the various positions in light of Scripture, and then re-engage with a godly perspective.
Pastor Wood is the founder and executive director of Ware's Valley Ranch, a Christian home and school for kids from crisis situations.
Jesus said, "As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Abide in my love."
You can contact the program by calling 866-41-ABIDE or by visiting us on the web at pastorwood.org. And now, here's your host, Jim Wood.
Folks, we are reaching back into the archives in order to bring you an interview that needs to be heard. Some years ago, we interviewed Dr. Peter Singer, who is the renowned so-called ethicist, who holds an endowed chair of ethics at Princeton University, no less. He is a man with many great distinguishing achievements, but he does not know the truth. He suppresses the truth that he does know in unrighteousness. And so we talked with him, and it may give you an idea of why so much in our culture is so confused when people like this are the ones who are telling others about right and wrong. Folks, every now and then it's good to hear from the other side, as it were. And we, I think, may surprise you today with our guest on the program. Dr. Peter Singer has been referred to on this broadcast before. A lot of people see him as sort of the boogeyman. And every now and then, if the boogeyman is willing to give an interview, it's good to hear what he has to say, because we won't gain ground by misstating or misunderstanding what those who oppose us are saying. All that does is allow them to say, well, you misunderstood. So I thought it would be helpful to have Dr. Singer come on our program and talk about his views concerning ethics. Let me read a statement from some folks who were very upset that Princeton University hired Dr. Singer. "We, the undersigned, protest the hiring of Dr. Peter Singer as the Ira DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University's Center for Human Values. We protest his hiring because Dr. Singer denies the intrinsic moral worth of an entire class of human beings, newborn children, and promotes policies that would deprive many infants with disabilities of their basic human right to legal protection against homicide. In his book, Practical Ethics, Dr. Singer states that no infant has as strong a claim to life as a rational, self-conscious human being. Dr. Singer's criteria for distinguishing newborn infants from, quote, normal human beings, including more mature infants, thus hinge on subjectively imposed conditions such as rationality, autonomy, and self-consciousness," close quote. "This lesser claim to life is also applied to those older children or adults whose mental age is and has always been that of an infant. His assertion of the appropriateness of killing some human beings based on others' decision concerning the quality of their lives should strike fear into everyone who cherishes equality and honors human life. Furthermore, Dr. Singer defines certain disabled persons as individuals who are living a, quote, life worth living. His views permit the killing of certain newborn infants with disabilities up to 28 days after birth. Dr. Singer states that killing a disabled infant is not morally equivalent to killing a person. Very often, it is not wrong at all," close quote. Dr. Singer's message threatens individuals with disabilities and contributes to the erosion of the public's regard for the fundamental human rights of disabled people. Finally, Dr. Singer suggests that the regulated killing of babies with spina bifida be permitted. He would extend to parents the authority to replace a Down syndrome or hemophiliac infant, that is, kill the child and conceive another, if adequate family or societal resources were not forthcoming. Even though Dr. Singer concentrates on disabled infants, the ethical arguments and metaphors that he provisionally adopts leave open the potential empowerment of parents to kill a non-disabled newborn whose replacement would ameliorate their prospects for a happy life. The hiring of Dr. Peter Singer to a professorial chair in ethics at a university as prestigious as Princeton will certainly, though perhaps unintentionally, legitimate his claims. Thus legitimated, Dr. Singer will use the platform afforded by Princeton to continue to argue for the killing of certain disabled babies, and his teachings may help cast the practice of infanticide in a more respectable light. Further, his teaching may encourage the propagation of infanticide. The hiring of Dr. Peter Singer is a blatant violation of Princeton University's policy of respect for people with disabilities. Princeton University's commitment to the community specifically states, abusive or harassing behavior, verbal or physical, which demeans, intimidates, threatens, or injures another because of his or her personal characteristics or beliefs, is subject to university disciplinary sanctions. Examples of personal characteristics or beliefs include, but are not limited to, sex, sexual orientation, race, ethnicity, national origin, religion, and handicap. Dr. Singer's view that many disabled babies may be rightly killed demeans and threatens those with handicaps. His ideology reinforces the false notion that many disabled persons' lives are less worth living and are inherently inferior to the lives of others. Despite his assurances that he rejects discrimination against the adult disability population, it is demeaning to suggest to them that their parents would have been justified in killing them as newborns. If Princeton University is committed to upholding the principles of non-discrimination, it must rescind its decision to hire Dr. Peter Singer. Well, of course, Princeton didn't rescind its decision. It hired Dr. Peter Singer, and you will hear in the interview that I have with him that he continues to argue that it's okay to kill sons like mine. Naturally, he is not a friend to me. But I do want you to hear firsthand what the Bible describes as a fool. A man who has concluded that there is no God, and he states that on the program. This is a man that the world looks to teach us about ethics, about right and wrong, and he is a fool. Dr. Singer, appreciate your coming on the program with us today.
That's my pleasure.
Peter Singer was born in Melbourne, Australia in 1946, educated at the University of Melbourne and the University of Oxford. He's the founding president of the International Association of Bioethics and the founding co-editor of the journal Bioethics. Outside academic life, he is the co-founder and president of the Great Ape Project, an international effort to obtain basic rights for chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans. He's also president of Animal Rights International. Your works have appeared in 20 languages. Author of the major article on ethics in the current edition of Encyclopedia Britannica. Clearly, we are speaking with someone who is a very influential thinker, and not without controversy. Dr. Singer, tell us, why do you believe your views are perceived as so controversial?
I think that it's the role of a philosopher to ask awkward questions. That's what Socrates did more than 2,000 years ago. And I think we need to have our complacency questioned, mm-hmm. and some of the moral attitudes that we basically take for granted, that we don't think about very much, mm-hmm. I do question. And they include views about the moral status of animals. For example, mm-hmm. are we justified in eating animals when mm-hmm. we don't really need to eat them in order to be healthy? Mm-hmm. And I question some aspects about the traditional ethic of the sanctity of human life, mm-hmm. which I think modern medical technology has shown doesn't really hold up in some of the situations that now confront us.
Now, you are a utilitarian in terms of your view of philosophy or ethics, is that right?
That's correct.
What would you say, just to summarize briefly, is the underlying principle that guides you in deciding what is right and what is wrong?
Well, the crucial principle is what will the consequences of the action be? Not just the immediate consequences, but the consequences for all those who are affected by it now and as far as we can foresee the future. Mm-hmm. And particularly in terms of the consequences, I'm thinking about, is this going to give the beings affected by what I do, and I say beings rather than people because mm-hmm. I do include consequences for non-human animals,
yes.
is it going to give them something which is essentially in accordance with their preferences, with their desires, that satisfies their needs and wants and interests, mm-hmm. or is it going to be something that on balance is more contrary to what they want and need and desire, and that frustrates or thwarts those preferences. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that you have a fair likelihood, a reasonable likelihood, of being able to accurately predict the consequences of actions?
Oh, well, I think it totally depends on the circumstances, how confident we can be about our predictions. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, we can be surprised in any sort of case, but mm-hmm. I think there are circumstances where you can be justified in having a high degree of confidence as to what the consequence of your actions will be, and there are other circumstances in which you have to be, you know, much more careful. You have to acknowledge that you could be getting things quite wrong. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, and I think this faces anyone, whether a utilitarian or not, the problem is that, you know, just not acting is not a way of avoiding having consequences, because mm-hmm. obviously we face choices to do something or not to do something. And if we just say, well, I'm not sure what the consequences will be, so I'm going to do nothing, mm-hmm. That's a moral choice as well. And of
Certainly.
Course, that might well have worse consequences
Certainly.
Than deciding to do something.
I would certainly agree with that. In the church, that's referred to as sins of omission, which are just as serious at times as sins of commission.
Right, and that's exactly what the consequentialist position would say, mm-hmm. that we are responsible for our omissions as well as our commissions.
Yes. As you, for instance, were opposed rather bitterly by some folks in Germany who felt that your views, if you look at the consequences that could result, lead to the same sort of approach to life that the Nazis promoted, you felt that was an unfair criticism. Can you talk about that a little bit?
At a philosophical level, the really important difference, I think, is that the Nazis had a racist ideology where they subordinated the individual to the race or to the state, to mm-hmm. you know, both of them somewhat abstract mm-hmm. conceptions, which mm-hmm. allowed them to commit the most terrible atrocities, which I think a consequentialist, you know, could never ignore the suffering of the millions of people that were killed as a result of the Nazi actions.
But if the Nazis had used something less potent than sarin gas, which kills very quickly, then I would understand you're referring to the suffering aspect. Are you speaking of the suffering of those who were left behind?
Look, we're talking about, you know, just never mind the sort of the war and all of that caused, which is
right.
just focusing on the Holocaust against Jews and gypsies and
but weren't
and so
they
on. I mean,
weren't they doing what they thought was best for society in terms of getting rid of what they perceived to
no,
be vermin?
No, I think that they were doing what they thought was best for them, i.e. for people of Aryan descent.
Mm-hmm.
But they were certainly not at all interested in the interests of the people that they were killing. And, you know, you can find that in Nazi statements. I quote some in my book. It doesn't concern them at all what suffering these people go through, whereas for someone like myself, as I say, you have to take account of the effects of your actions
right.
for everyone, not just for yourself or for people who are like you.
But there were certainly some who felt that they should, that the Jews should be killed in a humane way, that they should be killed with a minimum of suffering. They certainly didn't
yes,
care
I mean,
about them as far as dignity was concerned, but as far as minimizing the suffering and being efficient.
It's not simply dignity that I'm talking about. I mean, they didn't care about the fact that the Jews wanted to go on living. They didn't care about the fact that these were families, you know, who were just like you and me, who were looking forward to continuing their life, to seeing their children grow up, to falling in love,
mm-hmm.
To, you know, going on with their work.
So the wishes of those who die makes an enormous difference in your view.
Absolutely, it's totally central. It's
okay.
totally crucial.
Spina bifida children, for example, do you feel that that we have the right to kill spina bifida children? For instance, my oldest boy was born with spina bifida, and I know that that's one of the groups that you have at times been criticized by. Is survivors? They feel that you devalue their lives.
Right.
You feel pretty confident in your position that it's okay to kill spina bifida babies up to 28 days?
Firstly, let me say that the 28-day guideline I don't actually hold anymore. That you're quoting from a book that was written about 20 years ago, I think,
okay.
there.
Okay. What would be your guideline now?
Well, I don't think you can actually put any kind of day limit on it. I do
okay.
think you have to look at individual cases. And
would it be okay to kill them at 6 months? I mean, if well, say for instance with my son. Now, when he was 3 days old, neurosurgeon at Children's Hospital said, "Mr. Wood, you don't have to worry about this ever happening to you again." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, we can now detect these children in the womb." And I said, "And repair the defect," which of course now they can. Vanderbilt University has shown that, but at that time, that isn't what he meant at all. He said, no, we can terminate the pregnancy. And I said, oh, well, I said, here's his room right here. I said, why don't we go in and kill him now? If it's okay to kill him before he's born, why can't we go ahead and do it now? He's only a few days old. I don't see what the big difference is. And he said, oh, I see that I've offended you. And I said, well, yes, you have. And he said, well, I realize it's an emotional issue. I said, I'm not being emotional. I said, I'm asking you, what is wrong with killing him now? And he turned around and walked away. I then asked the chief of neurosurgery to make sure that that man never came near my son again, because I really don't want people who think that my son would be better off dead responsible for my child's treatment. And, you know, obviously, I respect your right to your views, but I still have a little trouble following your logic. At points, it may just be because your intellect is so far beyond mine, but it seems to me that you're saying that right and wrong has to do with our anticipated projection concerning the consequences in terms of meeting people's preferences. And I may be misstating, but
yes,
please correct me.
No, you're stating that quite correctly. And I think your question to the doctor was a good one. Obviously, this is an issue on which you and I agree that there is no crucial difference between ending the life of a human being a month or two before birth and ending it a day or two after birth.
Right. I would agree with that.
Yeah, so I think we do agree with that. I guess the difference between us is that you seem to think that you can derive ethics from something, I presume, religious.
Yes, I believe that God has revealed that there is a God, that he created all things, and that he has revealed what is right and what is wrong to man. So I have a different frame of reference from yours.
Yes, and I firstly don't believe that there is a God. Secondly, right. If there were a God, I don't think we have any basis for taking any particular set of the various conflicting scriptures or interpretations of scriptures as better founded than any other. So I think we still, even if we did believe in God, would really have to work out for ourselves what is the right thing to do. I don't think there are any easy answers just from religious belief in trying to decide what is the right thing to do, because we know that there are many people who equally firmly believe in totally different and incompatible religions and totally different and incompatible ethics. So I don't think we can just say, well, you know, I'm quite sure that I've got the right one, because...
Well, I think we can. I mean, again, that's a point of difference between our views. I feel that it is possible to say this is the right and this is the wrong based on belief in what we consider revealed truth. You believe, no, it's not okay to do that. But when you do that, you're doing it.
Just
when
then.
You reject my view, you're doing the very thing that you accuse me of doing, and that
is
making the decision about what's right and what's wrong based on what you believe to be the overriding authority.
No, there's no authority. I don't think there is authority here. I'm putting forward reasons and arguments which you and any of your listeners are able to consider, reflect on, provide objections to, as you've just been doing, and I hope that through that process we'll eventually come to a better defended and better justified ethical view, but it's but it's certainly not a matter of authority. I don't think there are any authorities in this area. There are just people who think about it and written about it and put forward arguments that seem to stand up to examination and reflection, and there are others that I think don't stand up. That's the difference.
No, I understand. I think that, you know, if I understand your position correctly, the quote is, my work is based on the assumption that clarity and consistency in our moral thinking is likely in the long run to lead us to hold better views on ethical issues. Did I get the quote correct?
I think you got that absolutely correct.
Okay.
Yes.
And I suppose what I'm saying is that, you know, sounds very cool and analytical, and it's very theoretical. But if someone were to assault you or a member of your family, if they were to kill you or a member of your family, I think you would be able to say with tremendous moral clarity that what they had done was wrong. And you would feel that that was a statement you could make categorically. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're not wrong about that. But you seem to be suggesting that that's somehow contrary to the quote that you read, and I can't quite see why it is.
No, I'm not suggesting it's contrary to the quote. I'm suggesting that your philosophy allows you to be able to state categorically, this is right, this is wrong, but based on what? And it's based on your conclusions within your finite intellect about what would be the better consequence. Yeah. What will be the outcome of this?
Well, when you say categorically, I mean, I guess I could always be wrong, right? I mean,
That's exactly right. So I don't think you'd say, well, I think it was wrong of you to kill my child, but I could be wrong. I think instead you would say, it was wrong! Exclamation point. The Holocaust, slaughtering the Jews, was wrong. The Nazis were wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, despite what you said about the finiteness of our intellect and so on, it seems undeniable that that is true. It's very, you know, pretty much impossible to think of reasons why that could be justified given that happened.
But I agree with you in that regard. Now, the problem I have is you are willing to look to your finite intellect as basically being the ultimate arbiter of right and wrong. I look beyond my intellect to what I perceive, rightly or wrongly, as a higher power, a greater intelligence, one who created the universe, life.
You're not really looking beyond your intellect because it's only your intellect which leads you to believe these claims.
Well, right? that's your opinion. I disagree with that statement as well.
I see. So I'm not quite sure what it could be, other than your intellect, your judgment about the existence of a God, which is something we could, of course, talk about. Mm-hmm. Why one would believe that, and in particular, why then one might say that I presume it's the Christian scriptures. We haven't talked about that mm-hmm. that are the ones that this God has revealed. Mm-hmm. Those are judgments that you make. They're subject, yes, I think, to intellectual discussion and
absolutely
to criticism.
Absolutely. I think they are. And, of course, again, we're approaching this from vastly different worldviews, but it seems to me that your position is one that our listeners need to be aware of and need to be acutely aware of, because you are one of the most influential thinkers on the planet today.
Well, so some people have said. I'm not at all sure about that myself. I think there's a lot of people who are a lot more influential. But
no, I think it's true, and I think it's having a powerful impact. Your view and those of your colleagues having powerful impact in the area of sexual mores, et cetera. One of the things that I had thought naively when I first wanted to interview you was that perhaps we could talk about why, if this is right, this would be wrong. And what I found as I began to read your material is the things that I thought would be a bit embarrassing for you in terms of logical next step, you're not embarrassed about at all. You are not opposed to bestiality as long as it doesn't involve cruelty to the animal. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty odd. I think the horror that people have about this is totally out of proportion to any harm that it might do.
But see, some of us would say that anybody wants to have sex with an animal, you would say an animal of another species, is not thinking right. But that's a judgment, isn't it? That's a moral judgment, and we have to base that on something if we're going to be consistent.
Right, and as I said, I base it on, is this causing harm to any being, to themselves or to the animal involved?
Well, again, I appreciate your taking time to talk with us, and I can't say I'm an admirer of yours, but I am certainly impressed by the influence that you wield, and I think that you have miscalculated when it comes to the consequences long term of the views that you espouse. I think that the folks who booed you in Germany were correct in anticipating where this leads, but obviously you hold a different position, and I respect your right to do so, sir.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate your willingness to talk about it. I note from what you said that you are, in a sense, also concerned about the consequences of what's happening.
Absolutely.
And that's obviously an issue that can be discussed a lot further. Let me just say on the German issue that I actually just got back 2 days ago from a talk in Germany, and I'm pleased to say that nobody was booing this time, so maybe they've learned a little bit more about my position in the meantime.
Or perhaps they're one step closer to Nazism.
I don't think so. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. You've been listening to Abiding in Christ. If you have questions that you'd like for us to tackle on the program or comments you want to make, I want to invite all of you to contact us at 866-41-ABIDE. That's our toll-free number, 866-41-ABIDE, or contact us on the web at pastorwood.org. That's pastorwood.org.